thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Taliban insurgents attacked the U.S. embassy in Afghanistan. U.S. officials warned Pakistan against harboring militants. Rebels in Libya battled pockets of Gaddafi loyalists. Gaddafi himself eluded capture. In Iran, an internal power struggle placed the fate of two American hikers on hold, and the EU is grappling with a worsening debt crisis. Joining me in the studio to talk about the week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, we welcome Shashank Bengali of McClatchy Newspapers for the first time. Thanks for being here. Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy Magazine, Matt Fry of the UK's Channel 4 News. And as always, your calls, your comments are welcome. We'll open the phones in just a few moments. I wonder, Matt Fry, if I could start with you. The European Finance Ministers meeting in Poland this week. What's going on?
Well, what's going on is that the glorious Eurozone is on the brink of something really rather ghastly and has been for some time. And what has happened in the last week is that Europe's finance ministers, having spent most of the year bickering with each other, have now managed to get together and decided that they would try and avert any contagion coming from Greece by basically flooding the banks with enough money that if there were to be a banking crisis, the banks would not seize up. There would be enough cash in the system to keep things running on a day-to-day basis, as there almost wasn't in 2008. But the bigger picture here, Diana, and it is an alarming one, and it's one that was reinforced in an interview that I did yesterday with the president of the World Bank, Robert Zoellick, is that there simply isn't enough political leadership in Europe to try and deal with the fundamental crisis. And that is the question at the heart of this whole project. How can you have fiscal union without having political union? How can you have something like the United States in monetary terms, but not in political terms? And you remember that old cliche, when America sneezes, the world catches cold. Well, now it's when Greek snivels, the world catches pneumonia.
Susan Glasser.
Well, two quick observations on that. Number one, forget about the Greek cold. It's, the Italian flu that we need to worry about next.
Or Spanish flu.
Well, exactly. And I think that has what's been prompted this heightened level of concern is an awareness that Italy's financial position is just truly unsustainable at this moment. I was struck also by Christine Lagarde's debut this week, her public debut in her new position as the head of the IMF, in which she came in and she made this point very strongly that it's a political crisis that has now full-fledged been triggered by the economic crisis, and that it's the failure of political leadership that is leading us into what seems to be almost a checklist of worst case scenarios. I was struck. I went back and I looked at just such a list that we ran in early August. We said, what's the worst case scenario at this point? What are the things we should be worried about? And honestly, almost every single one of those are in contention, from inflation in the emerging markets to the potential of a double dip recession. We are looking at almost all of them potentially playing out in a very negative way.
And yet, Shashank, it sounds, I was surprised to hear that Brazil and its fellow BRIC countries are thinking about supporting the Eurozone.
Well, this is very interesting. The BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, the sort of emerging powers around the world, actually weighing in at this moment and saying, hey, we can lend a hand to Europe in this case. It's sort of the world turned on its head a bit. I was wondering whether the Brazil proposal wasn't a bit of self-serving. I mean, they've always seen themselves as trying to be a bridge from the developing world to sort of the old the older world Europe and such. And I heard a number of commentators say in the past couple of days that the amount of money Brazil is talking about injecting isn't really sufficient to do a huge amount of give a huge amount of help to what Europe needs, especially if you're considering about having to prop up both Italy and Spain, much bigger economies than Greece's down the road.
But they must just love the idea of even being heard as a credible voice of intervention.
Exactly.
And not just the Brazilians, of course, the Chinese have cropped up and said, look, we could help the Italians, for instance. And I think, you know, you mentioned it, there's a certain self-serving interest here. Well, in China, that's doubly the case, because China's economy does not grow at 8% or more a year if they can't export stuff to Europe and the rest of the world. And if Europe isn't buying Chinese stuff, the Chinese economy is in a bad way.
But self-serving is good.
It is good.
In this case.
We're all in this together. There are no islands
absolutely.
In this particular crisis.
Well, for now, China is an island. So the question is, you know, they're the only ones who do, in fact, have the resources to make a substantial contribution to the European mess at this point. Whether they will and on what terms, very much up in the air. In fact, there's no certainty at the end of this week. It doesn't look any clearer than it did at the beginning of the week that China would intervene in a significant
way. But they do need to export an awful lot in order to keep the economy going.
Absolutely.
And the one thing I've talked to Chinese officials about this, and they're very honest about it. They say the one thing that inspires just about everything we do in foreign, domestic, and economic policy is whether we can keep those factories running. Because the minute that stops, they face social unrest on a massive scale.
So U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner is attending this meeting really unusual here. What's he saying?
Well, you know, clearly this, you know, the bigger question is this United States of Europe, I think, down the line. We can avert a crisis here with an injection of cash into the banks. But down the line, is there a solution for Europe to become a real union, fiscally and not just monetarily? This is, I think, the biggest question. And I don't know if Geithner is going to raise it, but he ought to.
Go on.
Further integration on some level is the direction we're moving away from at the moment. And I think, you know, the spotlight turns right back to Germany, which has been playing the pivotal role in these negotiations. The German public has signaled every way possibly can that it is not in the mood to continue offering blank checks on the back of their hard work to a sort of debt and corruption-plagued Southern Europe. And so I think the prospect of rifts really seriously occurs. 3 years ago, even at the beginning of the financial crisis, it was hard to imagine that we would end up having a conversation about the splintering of the Eurozone. And yet we are very much having that conversation.
How likely is it that Greece would either default or withdraw from the Eurozone?
Well, if you talk to even some Greek officials, they will say, look, a default is inevitable. What we should be doing is cutting our losses, have that wonderful new word, the drachmatization of the Greek economy, something to remember. Go back to our original currency. Because by hanging on longer, what you're doing is you're turning that boil, if I can use that rather nasty image, into something really septic. Because the contagion doesn't need to spread as much as many people fear it would, because a lot of the banks have already deleveraged themselves from Greece, French banks, German banks. The markets have kind of factored in the Greek scenario.
But what happened to Greece?
But here's the point, Dan. 2 points, really. If you wait too long, the problem becomes much worse.
Okay.
And what Christine Lagarde and Robert Zoellick were saying yesterday is what FDR said at the height of the Great Depression, what we have to fear most is fear itself. Because the one thing you don't want is what we had in 2008, and that is panic. Because through panic, all this does become toxic for everyone, because then all the bets are off. And if you really want to change Greece, it's not just about the sticky back plastic of a couple of billion here or a couple of billion there. It is about changing the economic culture of Greece, where only a fraction of people pay their taxes and everyone assumes they can retire at the age of 55.
Well, that's right. I think, though, a couple things that have been interesting to note as the fear of fear has crept back into our dialogue this week. Two things. One, you're hearing the resurrection of the Great Depression analogy, probably hearing more about that than you have at any time in the last 3 years. And what's the analogy people are making? It wasn't the Wall Street crash, but it was the bank crisis that followed that really led to the taking hold of the global Great Depression. And of course, that's the possibility we face right now, is of a European banking crisis, number one. Number two, I think, is this question of contagion and political will. we are Americans, right? We're big believers in action, any action in the face of a crisis. And I think one of the things that's been very humbling about this financial crisis is that we seem determined to unlearn the lessons of history here. And the lessons of history are it takes much, much longer than you think to put into place structural changes. And number two, political action can only do so much in the face of economic and structural problems like those that we face right now.
Do you believe that Greece will default, Susan?
I believe that the Greek political class believes it's inevitable that they will default. And the question that we're arguing over is the terms of and how and the timing in particular. Arguably, this has been known by the sort of financial elites for the last several years that this was inevitable and that what Europe did successfully last year was not solve the Greek crisis. What Europe did last year was successfully put off the resolution of the Greek crisis.
Shashank, would you go along with that thinking?
I think they're both right. I think the elites have known for some time. I think a short-term default on terms that can be agreed to and then move past is probably the way this is going to go. And then the question is, how do we shore up the remainder of the economy for the longer term?
I think one of the really interesting questions, which I think you touched on, Susan, is also in discussing political leadership. What we've all realized is that the political class in Europe, be it in France, be it in Germany, be it in Greece or Italy, has not been honest, have never been honest with their electorates about what the real terms of the euro are and whether it's worth the sacrifice.
Matt Fry, he's Washington correspondent for the UK's Channel 4 News. Short break, and do join us, 800-433-8850. And welcome back to the International Hour of our Friday News Roundup. Here this week, Susan Glasser. She's editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy Magazine. Matt Fry, Washington correspondent for the UK's Channel 4 News. And Shashank Bengali, he's national security editor for McClatchy News. We're going to open the phone shortly. First, though, let's talk about the visits of world leaders to Tripoli and Benghazi in the post-Gaddafi era. Susan.
Yes, we saw the dramatic scene of Prime Minister Cameron and President Sarkozy of France flying into free Tripoli to take a victory lap. They were pretty remarkable scenes. Obviously, it's still a very unsettled situation in Libya today. And I frankly was surprised that they decided to sort of go so quickly into this capital. Remember, Gaddafi himself is still on the loose, along with at least parts of his family.
Where is he?
Good question, you know.
He's at Whole Foods,
right,
just down the road.
Exactly. He's, no, I think he's in Iraq in Saddam's bowl, right? Exactly. It was meant to be a victory lap, but if so, it was a victory lap with a lot of question marks and asterisks attached.
A lot of fighting continued in certain
fighting, but there's infighting among the rebels, and I think this is something that's going to be an emerging story to keep your eyes on. it's much, much easier to unite people in the cause of toppling a tyrant who's put his boot on your heel, so to speak, for the last four decades than it is to really have political consensus about what should follow, especially in a society that has been so isolated as Libya. You're seeing rifts inside that governing council, the transitional national council between the Islamists and the actually regime turncoats who have been leading it and been the public figures. Jabril and Jalil gave a big public sort of rally in the streets of Tripoli at the same time. The sniping is not even occurring privately anymore, but publicly and very much out in the open.
Shashank.
You know, it's very easy. As difficult as this 6 or 7 month campaign against Gaddafi's regime has been, it's much easier, as we know, to break things than to make things. And I sort of read the pretty stunning stories of Sarkozy and Cameron in Tripoli to be an effort by these countries which had led the NATO intervention to in some ways close that chapter a bit and move on. You know, they've got, as we've just been discussing, pretty big problems in their own pocketbooks. And Libya now, after all the hand-wringing about it, in some ways can be seen as a success in the West. However, as Susan pointed out, just tremendous questions. I mean, we have a long way to go in this country. The rebel leadership has made efforts to, I shouldn't call them rebels anymore, the revolutionary leadership has made efforts to come to Tripoli, but for the most part, they're remaining in the eastern capital of Benghazi. Tripoli remains kind of a shell city and not one that they can govern from.
So what does Libya need now?
Needs a strong man. No, I'm joking. But I think what it needs is for us to get to be slightly more patient and less judgmental. To be honest, I take all the points on board that we've just heard in the last 5 minutes, but at the same time, being optimistic for a second, if I may, they've had their 7 months of a bruising, entrenched conflict in which the National Transition Council could actually get to grips with transition, perhaps more than they would have done if this conflict had been quicker. There is an influx of Libyan exiles from Britain and the US and all over the world who are trying to, you know, resurrect that country. You know, after 43 years 42. Of Gaddafi, in which all the tribal differences brewing, you know, at the heart of Libyan culture and society were basically sublimated by this one strong man, you know, it's going to be tough to form some sort of viable government. But give them a chance. I mean, they've only just started. Mm. And if you look around the region, there is all sorts of reason to be alarmed about how these transitions, these post-revolutionary transitions, are working. But not all of them are miserable, and some of them are still in the middle of a revolution and might be failing. Like
here's a message on Facebook from Tom. He says, humanitarian conditions worsen in Sirte. Will NATO intervene to save the people?
Well, I mean, that's its remit. The whole remit of NATO is to stop any sort of aggression against civilians. And, of course, you have to ask yourself whether the bombing of Gaddafi's compounds in Sirte, which is his birthplace, or in Bani Walid, where he also has a strong base, is really about completing regime change, or is it about protecting civilians? Mm. But at the same time, we have been in a worse place in this ongoing agonizing conflict than we are now. And I think, you know, I mean, despite the irony of seeing David Cameron being cheered by the Libyans when Tony Blair was hugging Colonel Gaddafi in, when was it, 2004? Let's just forget that for a moment, shall we? There is a real, you know, effort here, and I think it's quite deftly handled to keep the footprint of the West relatively light in what's going on in Libya, both in military terms and political terms, and give them some space to try and rebuild themselves. And Libya, as a rather special case, probably has a better chance of doing that than some other countries in the region.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. If anything, I would say that a few months from now, regardless of how things turn out inside this new leadership, Libya won't even be on our radar screen. The situation in Syria, on the other hand, I think is a much more serious ongoing thing. I wouldn't be surprised. The UN came out with figures this week saying that more than 2,600 civilians have been killed in the crackdown by the Assad regime. I wouldn't be surprised if this ends up being a much bloodier conflict inside Syria than the one we've just witnessed in Libya.
Who is little Gandhi?
Well, you know, this was a tragic story among many, many tragic stories this week. You know, this was a young man, I think he was days away from his 25th birthday, who was killed and delivered to his parents' home. He was a tailor. He was an activist. He was, I think, a symbol in many ways of the sort of leaderless but yet very, very compelling and human resistance that has taken place in organically almost in cities around Syria. And that, you know, on the one hand might be its weakness. You know, there's no TNC for us to get behind. There's no one rebel leader or dissident figure who has emerged that can be rallied around, that the West can endorse and support. The flip side is this is really it's an organic uprising. And this young man's death, I think, has really sort of captured in a way part of the human story that's going on here.
It's interesting. AP is reporting from Beirut that Syrian troops killed at least 17 people today in raids on anti-government protesters, but they failed to stop thousands from pouring into the streets nationwide and taking their uprising against President Assad's autocratic rule into a seventh month. These people who know they will be shot moving out into the streets.
This is what happened in Egypt eventually that turned the tide, this feeling. Of course, it happened more quickly there because the military and the protest numbers were so huge. But once the people conquered their fear in the streets of Cairo, they were able to remain on the streets in the face of police brutality, thug brutality. In Syria, it's very difficult to get clear reporting out of there because of the restrictions the regime has put out. So we're relying on reporting from Beirut and from a small but brave number of people inside Syria. What we hear, of course, is that every day people are in the streets, and every Friday after prayers, the numbers are at their greatest. But how long this can go on, you know,
exactly.
Our levers to really pressure the Assad regime are very few. And I think, you know, that's the difference we face in from Egypt and Libya, where we had some levers. Syria, we have very dissatisfactory ones.
I think that's a really good point, because what we're learning is the lesson of the perils of isolation. And Syria, rather like Burma, which was completely isolated by most of the world apart from China, Syria isolated by most of the world apart from, you know, Russia and Iran, a bit of China, it's much more difficult to exert any sort of influence on those regimes.
And the sanctions, nothing.
Well, the sanctions should work, but the thing is, what you're dealing with, I mean, here's the difference. Egypt had a military that was basically financed by the US. So the generals at some stage were sat down by someone from the Pentagon and said, look, if you want your shiny toys next year, this is what you've got to do. There is no one to take the shiny toys away in the Syrian regime, and they have nothing to lose other than, you know, than being in power.
But speaking of the Egyptians, a mob attacked the Israeli embassy in Cairo. Was that a coordinated attack, Susan?
Well, it certainly had some of the hallmarks of it, and I think, you know, it also was a jolt to the world community, because it was a reminder that for, you know, 7 months now, 9 months now, we've been lost in the Arab Spring and not so much, you know, sort of almost taking a relieved break from the Israel-Palestine issue, telling ourselves in many ways that this was not at the heart of this, that it wasn't going to come back, that, okay, there was some nervousness at the beginning, but Egypt and Israel are going to work things out. You know what? I think we're in for a very rocky period. Next week is the UN General Assembly. We're headed for a major showdown. The Palestinian leadership has determined that they are going to go and ask for a major upgrading in status. They're potentially going to go to the UN Security Council.
Is it going to get to the UN Security Council?
Well, you know, we don't exactly know yet. The rumblings today are that they are determined and that Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of the Palestinian Authority, is determined to go ahead and take this step, which would trigger a certain U.S. veto and would really cause a major rift. Of course, we are the major funder of the Palestinian Authority, in addition to our enormous military aid to Israel. So the consequences here are very high. We just sent two American envoys in a last-ditch effort yesterday to persuade them not to take this step. And you know what the answer was? Sorry, guys.
We've
You're
heard
too
this
late.
Before.
You're
We've
too
heard
late.
The same
yeah.
old,
That's right.
But the other fallout from this attack on the embassy is that you've got the re-enlistment of emergency rules.
Indeed. I mean, the emergency law was never taken off the table completely. Bits of it have lingered rather distastefully on the shelf for some time, since the revolution in Tahrir Square. The Egyptian military is obviously terrified that the incidents like the one we saw last week with the Israeli embassy will escalate and that this becomes something that is completely out of hand, that could even lead to some sort of, the end of diplomatic relations with Israel, but further down the line, some sort of action, military action from the Israelis. That's the last thing the Egyptian military wants to deal with. They are totally focused on internal crowd control. But by bringing back the emergency law, all they're going to do is inflame the public. What they need to do is stick to their plan, have the elections in November, set out some sort of, guideline towards transition, stick to it, and then go to the polls. Well, otherwise, this thing will fester.
What will the emergency law mean for those people?
Well, it means that you will be tried. For instance, the people involved in the Israeli embassy siege, raid, call it what you like, would be tried in a military court rather than a civilian court. There are several paragraphs of the emergency law banning public gatherings of a certain nature, destruction of public goods. I mean, it's fairly weasel-worded stuff that can be used by the military, should they want to crack down.
Matt Fry is Washington correspondent for the UK's Channel 4 News. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Susan, remind us what happened on Tuesday in Kabul.
Well, this was a coordinated and very serious attack. It took more than 24 hours, for them to subdue these insurgents. They took over basically a very strategically positioned building in downtown Kabul, used it to launch an attack on the U.S. Embassy, other parts of downtown Kabul. It was really a stark reminder, hey, guys, we're still here. It was only last week, I believe, that the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Ryan Crocker, was quoted as saying that the major problem in Kabul today was the bad traffic. And, so this was really a reminder that...
And how did they do this? That was the question. How did they manage to gain access to this vantage point? What did they do, Shashank?
It's pretty stunning. This is a 14-story unfinished or half-finished concrete building that was meant to be an office block, a privately owned building. Kabul is in the middle of a building boom, and there's a lot of unfinished buildings around town. However, there are very few that are within striking distance of the U.S. Embassy and NATO headquarters. So question number one is, who's building this building, and what the heck is it doing there? Secondly, there are questions about whether these insurgents were able to stash weapons in this building. They had police officers at the scene saying there was sacks of hand grenades, rocket-propelled grenades, bullets, a huge amount of ammunition. I mean, as Susan said, the siege went on for nearly 24 hours before it could be subdued by Afghan and international forces. So clearly a lot of coordination went into this. For me, the bigger question really, I mean, Ryan Crocker, the U.S. ambassador, the same day said that this was an instance of harassment and not a real attack. But I'm sure for the folks hunkered down in the embassy for 20 hours, this seemed more like harassment. As Crocker put it in those same remarks, there were RPGs bouncing off of the embassy walls. So the question is, we are beginning our military drawdown. Our international partners are beginning the drawdown along with us. These kinds of attacks are increasingly arriving in the capital, Kabul, where they had not been for a very long time. We had the siege of the hotel in Kabul a few months back. I mean, we have to really wonder, is this, as Crocker says, an instance of insurgents being desperate and launching these sort of spectacular attacks, or is it really a sign that they can continue to do this, on a regular basis?
Or is Pakistan helping these insurgents, Susan?
Well, both the Afghan officials and international officials were quick to point the finger at the Haqqani network, which is widely perceived to be the most effective force mounting attacks inside Afghanistan today. It's believed to be headquartered inside Pakistan in the region of North Waziristan. It's been a continuing flashpoint, I would say, of real tension between the United States and Pakistan. Why this safe haven, if you will, of the Haqqanis inside Pakistan is able to continue. And so I think, it does underscore some of the long-term things. But I just quickly on this point of, are we in a stage of wishful thinking? Let's remember the American public, much of the Republican Party's leadership and certainly their presidential campaigns, a large part of the liberal part of the Democratic Party, they've moved on from Afghanistan. We are, as far as Americans are concerned, out of there. So this contravenes the narrative, right? We don't want to hear about Afghanistan. We don't want to talk about it. Last week in the debate in California that the Republicans had, Afghanistan was mentioned only twice. Once when Ron Paul said, gee, we're spending $20 billion on air conditioning for our troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, and he thinks we should pull the plug on that. And then once when John Huntsman said we should get out of there as soon as possible and focus on nation building here at home. Rick Perry, somewhat controversially, seemed to echo that this week and then has spent the last 2 days walking back from his statement. But I think what you really see is that even Republicans, who have been the most gung-ho as a party up until now on the war, are no longer interested in talking about it.
Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy Magazine. When we come back from a short break, we'll open the phones, read your email. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Visa, whose Visa Signature credit card offers access to the movies this summer. Details at fandango.com/visa-signature. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by American Jewish World Service, supporting local solutions to global challenges at ajws.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Allison Pearson talks about her novel, I Think I Love You, about a girl obsessed with David Cassidy. It's just come out in paperback. The film adaptation of Pearson's other novel, I Don't Know How She Does It, opens this weekend. It stars Sarah Jessica Parker as a mother trying to keep up with her child and her high-pressure job. Join us.
Take a call from Ernie in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Great show. I'm a German immigrant and a proud American. All my family is over there, and I'm in communication with them a lot about the economic issues. I guarantee you that Germany is heading towards an inward view. They are going to vote in every election, maybe even precipitate a national election ahead of schedule, and they are going to pull out of the economic union. They're going to readopt the Deutschmark. These people are still paying for the reunification of Germany. They're fed up. I'm not saying I agree with that philosophy, but it is a lot worse than the media even understands.
What do you think?
Well, I'm a German immigrant, a proud Briton, and a very happy resident of the United States. And I have to say that I think to some extent the caller is right. On another level, he's not. It's politically the project of the euro, the project of Europe, the ever closer union, is not allowed to fail as far as the German elite is concerned. And what they need to do is to try and redefine what that project is all about to their own people. And that's where the caller is right. There is an increasing feeling, and I get this from my own family, why should we, the Germans, the richest nation in Europe, become the ATM machine of a Europe that doesn't necessarily deserve to get its hands on our money? Why should we bail out Greece or Italy or Spain when they haven't been paying their taxes? And that is a very valid point. But at the same time, one has to remember the historical emotional context in Germany in which the European Union was founded. And that is after the Second World War, to prevent that sort of calamity from ever happening again. And although that is an instinct that is more prevalent with my father's generation than with mine, or indeed my children's generation, it is still out there. It is in the historic and political DNA of Germany. And I think what if the leaders of Germany want to save the euro, what they need to say to their people, if you allow one country after another to opt out, and basically it's everyone for themselves, then this whole rather brittle edifice could fall apart. Do you really want
that? All right, let's hear another view from Mike in Fenton, Michigan. Good morning, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
We love you. You are a national treasure, Diane.
Thank you.
Which is more than we can say for our leaders at this point, Diane. I would like your guest to comment on this, Diane. We are all in this together. We need to help out Greece, the Italians, and Portugal. We shouldn't wait for the Europeans to help or allow this to go, you know, into a worser situation. If we help them, our markets will immediately take off. This will give the world the push we need to get out of this hole the politicians have allowed the world to get into. It's time to stop passing the buck. Isn't it, Diane? This downturn is an opportunity to show ourselves and the world what the Americans are all about.
What do you think, Shashank?
Well, the sentiment is well taken, but there's just no appetite politically in this country for another infusion of American cash, even in some quarters into American markets, let alone into European markets. You know, we are in this together, clearly, as Matt said, you know, the interconnectedness. When Greece sniffles, we get pneumonia, as he said. I mean, this is a major problem for the U.S., but there just isn't interest in a huge bailout.
All right, let's hear another view from Michael in Alexandria, Virginia. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for having me on your
show. Sure.
I was calling just to challenge the notion that default or orderly default is a bad thing. I mean, nobody talks about the big Russian default from 7-8 years ago.
Oh, dear. I'm afraid we've lost you, Michael. What do you think about that, Matt Frye?
Well, I think he made his point rather succinctly.
Yeah.
And I think he's right. I mean, if it is really to try and destigmatize what a default means that is now incumbent upon Europe's politicians, because it may well happen. Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, said only yesterday that she expects Greece to default by 2013. Well, if you're putting a timeline on it, why not, you know, rush it through the pipe and say, let's do it right now and let's do it in an orderly fashion? Remember, the one big problem that all the Eurozone countries have is that they are all tied together by this one currency. Therefore, they don't have the freedom to devalue their own currency in order to get out of that debt crisis. The only reason why that great island of ours, Great Britain, is still economically viable is that the pound was effectively devalued, the British pound, sterling, by Gordon Brown, the then Prime Minister, by roughly about 30%. Otherwise, Britain would be today's Greece.
Help me to understand what happens to the ordinary person in Greece if, in fact, there is a default. Susan.
You know, it's really impossible even to answer because there is no mechanism short of leaving the euro, for which there is also no mechanism. There is no mechanism for them to do that at the moment. So anything that Europe does as a policy matter will have to be negotiated from scratch at this point. There is no way for one country within the eurozone to default and not affect the rest of the currency. So they're going to have to come up. They're writing the script here for how this is going to happen.
Okay.
And that, of course, is going to determine what happens to the poor people in Greece who already, by the way, of course, have been through successive rounds of belt tightening and belt tightening and belt tightening. And what's so sad about it, of course, is that those measures are already exacting an enormous toll inside Greece, and yet they're wildly insufficient to deal with the scale of the problem.
All right. And here's a tweet. Greece's financial problems are their problem, the culture of financial corruption and economy in the tank. Dump the euro in Greece. What do you say to that, Shawshank?
Well, as Susan just said, that there really isn't a mechanism to dump, you know, in one country. We do have a situation now in Europe where there's a series of northern countries Germany, for example, the most robust country in Europe economically, has been very responsible in the way it's worked its system out. And you've got a series of failing economies and structural problems in the south. And at the moment, one country can't opt out. That's not how the system works.
All right. To Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning, Abdul.
Hey, Diana, how you doing?
Fine, thanks.
My question is, what is this Europe and crisis going to mean for West Africa and who has a franc CFA? Because you remember 1994, they devalued our money. So what is that going to mean for us?
Matt Frank.
Well, it could. First of all, there will be less money, obviously, if the euro were to be in a really serious crisis, or indeed were to collapse. The concerted European aid policy towards Africa. I can't put a number on it at the moment, but I'm imagining that there's more money there, and there's more of a policy directive there than there would be if these countries acted on their own. That presumably would crumble, or certainly be diminished. There would be less money to help countries like Libya. Rebuild. That would mean that there might be more Libyans or indeed African migrants washing over into Europe. Remember, one of Colonel Gaddafi's threats was, "I will inundate Europe with Libyans, with desperate Libyans trying to get a job somewhere. You know, if you don't get your hands off my country." And to some extent, we've seen in these rather dramatic pictures of people on rafts that this has already happened. Mm-hmm. And you know, within Europe, of course, that causes problems as well. For instance, there is in Europe an agreement called the Schengen Agreement, by which all the countries that sign up to this agreement can travel from one country to the next, from France to Germany to Italy, without ever having to show your passport to someone at the border. It's wonderful for people who live on the border or for tourists. Well, there was a huge argument this summer. Too many Libyans or people who'd worked in Libya were coming into Italy. The Italians weren't enforcing their sea borders. Where do these people go? They go straight from Italy to France and Germany. The French insisted that there should be border controls. And so it all falls apart. This whole argument about the Schengen Agreement, you know, is mirrored on a financial, on an economic level by the spats between the various finance ministers.
I'll just say two observations. I mean, I think Matt's totally right. Two things. Number one, it's inevitable that there will be less money for Africa, for humanitarian crises. We have a massive drought and famine in Somalia right now, the worst in a generation. There are people that are dying every day. And the appeals by the United Nations for humanitarian aid are falling terribly short. In the early 90s, we had a robust international intervention. The U.S. went in with troops, and of course that ended badly with the Black Hawk Down incident. But the goal of the mission was to bring aid to Somalia. The aid pledges are much, much lower this year. They're at a fraction of what's needed. The second point, though, and so there will be consequences, and we have to face those. The second point, though, is that we're in a different world than we were in the early 90s. We saw in Libya the huge role that Qatar played as an emerging power. They're really flexing their muscle on the world stage here. They were, beyond the military help they provided, which was instrumental in helping the Libyan rebels topple and take Tripoli, they were providing huge amounts of humanitarian aid at the Egyptian border, on the Tunisian border, for refugees leaving Libya. And we also saw countries like Turkey step in with their own aid. So we will leave a bit of a vacuum if we step back, but there are other countries that can fill it.
It's very interesting. Yesterday, pardon me, I spoke with the UNESCO representative to Haiti, who talked about the NGOs who are receiving monies from the U.S. and the fact that the government, which doesn't exist, is not getting money from the U.S. Same is true in Somalia. There is no government to successfully deliver that money.
Indeed, but I just want to add one more point to what you were saying, which I thought was really good, which is that you know, it's not just that Europe doesn't provide enough aid or that the United States is withdrawing further within its own borders, that basically the Western world is less interested, less engaged, less generous in that policy. But also, look out for China. The Chinese are providing tons of aid in return for commodities. There's, you know, the Chinese are basically using Africa as a huge kind of harvesting field for the commodities that their economy needs. And if you talk to people in Angola, you know, or Uganda, they'll say, you know what, we love that European aid. It's great. But actually, we're rather busy at the moment trying to set up a, you know, a new factory for our Chinese clients.
All right,
and they're basically propping up the economy.
LaSalle, Illinois. Good morning, Renee.
Hi. I am going back to Greece and setting the playbook for the euro and the default in Greece. Would there be any way of comparing this to a state in the United States going bankrupt? Is when you talk about Greece setting up their own playbook or drawing a new playbook, is there any way to compare this to something like that in the dollar zone?
Perhaps not a state, but a city like Detroit, like Cleveland, like many others.
New York, when, you know.
Exactly.
But, no question. That's why you have a lot of Europeans today scratching their heads and looking ruefully at the road not taken, which would have been a more United States of Europe confederation. And unfortunately, the ways in which they set up the Eurozone do not at the moment allow for this kind of scenario. And it's a classic case
future.
Of unintended consequences.
Yes. Even in the future?
Well, this is it. I think the real problem here is that whenever people, and some politicians have been saying this in Germany, in France, call for that ever closer union to become the United States of Europe, they're doing this at precisely the time when the cultural, mm-hmm. historic differences, the bickering, the finger pointing, have come to the fore. I mean, the number of swastikas that appeared on Greek walls saying, you know, this is basically just like the kind of stuff that, you know, that the Nazis did to us. I mean, outrageous out there, but basically there's a lot of anti-German feeling. There's a lot of anti-Greek feeling in Germany, as one of the earlier callers referred to. You know, this is the problem, that whole beehive of rather brittle national sentiments is being kicked.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go finally to Miami, Florida. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning. My question quickly is the recent discovery of natural gas in the eastern part of the Mediterranean off of Israel, what reference does Turkey's posturing have to do with the discovery of gas there and the revenue that Turkey might want to be able to have and what's happening with the flotilla for Palestinian aid?
Susan.
Well, I think, you know, in recent years, there have been significant finds of potential gas fields offshore for Israel in a way that would finally rewrite the resource map of the Middle East and give Israel, unlike its neighbors, it hasn't been blessed with these enormous reserves of oil or gas. Were they to become more energy independent, of course, were that to be a big new source of revenue, it would change the politics of the region. But that's not something that's going to happen tomorrow.
Finally, let's talk about what the latest is going on with the American hikers in Iran. Are they going to be released as Ahmadinejad, the president said, or are they not going to be released as the supreme leader said?
We're seeing, it's quite extraordinary. We're seeing another iteration of this conflict between Ahmadinejad, the president, and the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, play out, in this case involving the fate of two young Americans who've been held for more than 2 years now. Ahmadinejad said at first that you know, he's going to the UN next week and is going to speak in New York, which promises to be theatrical, I'm sure. He was hoping to, as some sort of a gesture to the West, conciliatory gesture, say that he was going to release these two men. But, of course, it just took a matter of days or hours even before the judiciary in Iran said that, no, that wasn't the case. So clearly we have a rift that's been going on now for more than a year in public view of the president, Ahmadinejad, trying to exert executive authority and constantly being just slapped down like a kid out of school by the judiciary and by the clerical leaders in Iran.
You know, it's really interesting. We tend to think of Iran as just another repressive, monolithic regime. But actually, ever since the Iranian Revolution, there has been this fissure at the heart of the country between the judiciary, between the clerics essentially, and the civilian leadership. It's interesting that Ahmadinejad has now got exactly the same problems that his predecessor, President Khatami, who was classed as a reformer in a city like Washington, encountered, and finally was his undoing. This is something which has not been revolved within Iran, and until it does, I think you're going to get very mixed signals out of that country.
Matt Fry of the UK's Channel 4 News, Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy Magazine, Shashank Bengali of McClatchy Newspapers. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Sarah Ashworth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.